The Kakadu plum is an Australian native superfood containing 100 times more vitamin C than oranges. So why have you never heard of it? PR. No one's drinking a Kakadu smoothie? I'm J.B. Smoove, and that was a full episode of my new podcast, Straightforward, inspired by guaranteed straightforward pricing from AT&T Fiber. Get what you want without the complicated. AT&T Fiber, live like a gigillionaire. Available wherever you get your podcast. Limited availability in select areas. Visit AT&T.com/hypergig for details.
You know you've got a comeback in you. When you take the next step, you're going to make it count. For your career, for your family, for your life. You can earn a degree you're proud of with Purdue Global. Purdue Global is backed by Purdue University, one of the nation's most respected and innovative public universities. This is your chance. This is your opportunity. This is your comeback. Purdue Global, Purdue's online university for working adults. Start your comeback today at purdueglobal.edu.
When you buy Kroger brand products, you feel like you're winning. That's because they offer proven quality at lower than low prices. In fact, we guarantee that you and your family will love how Kroger brand products taste, or you get your money back. So next time you're shopping for the family, look for delicious Kroger brand products, because they'll make you all feel like you're winning. Shop now, in-store, or online. Kroger, fresh for everyone.
LASIK. LASIK.com.
Have you been thinking about LASIK but not sure if you're a candidate? Just go to LASIK.com/quiz and take our free candidacy quiz. In just a few minutes, you'll know if LASIK is likely right for you. And if it is, we'll connect you with experienced LASIK doctors in your area. Start your journey towards 20/20 vision. Take our free candidacy quiz at LASIK.com/quiz. Yeah, LASIK.com. Easy to remember, so you know where to start.
LASIK. LASIK.com.
Hello, My Baby was a joke song?
A little bit, because hello was, the telephone was new when it was written.
Uh-huh.
So hello was a new slang word.
Hello was slang?
Hello was slang.
Hello?
Alexander Graham Bell thought we should answer the phone ahoy.
Right.
And that's why Burns.
Mr. Burns.
Mr. Burns says ahoy hoy.
Ahoy hoy.
because of that. But I guess people settled on hello, which was literally a slang word. It was like LOL of its time.
What?
And so they were like, that song is basically like LOL chat room baby or whatever. Like, that's what that song is essentially in its time.
So
it was like writing chat room lover or something.
Wow. Okay. So at the time, people were like, well, the kids these days, they're all saying hello to each other.
Hello, my baby. Hello, my honey. Hello, my ragtime gal.
Wow.
That song, I guess, is about a guy who met someone on the telephone, like he doesn't know her in real life.
Well, and which at the time, I guess, was like, remember when online dating was new and
yes.
It was like embarrassing
yes.
to say that you met someone online? And now it's literally the only way
the
to
only
do
way
it.
The only way to meet
people. As far as I know.
I didn't know
the phone was like that. That's funny.
I know.
That's
and
so interesting.
You know, this was a little internet post, should probably...
No. If you read it, I'm sure it was like, was it a tweet or a graphic somewhere?
It was a graphic.
Then I don't know. If we can't trust those, then what are we doing here? If we can't trust graphics we read on the internet with information presented as fact, then I feel like the world might be in trouble.
Big problems.
Yeah.
Big
fortunately,
problem.
We can trust that
yes.
as fact. So, look, I'm fascinated by it. I'm taking it as true. I will spread it far and wide, including on this podcast, which
right?
is about history.
Yeah.
And y'all can take that
take
as
that
fact
history.
From us.
It's facts. Facts in that it's a facsimile of a fact.
Oh, that's a clever twist on the word fact. Facsimile of the truth.
It's a fax. Online fax.
Your Honor, I did not say it was a fact.
What
I said it
was
a fact, as in facsimile.
Facsimile.
Unbelievable.
Do you think that'll hold up?
I think it'll hold up. Well, speaking of... The court of public opinion, of court in general.
True.
The legal system.
I love that. Way to tie it in.
We've got to find these places to make a smooth transition. Speaking of smooth transitions, speaking of explosive new information.
Ooh, there you go.
We've got a hot one today.
We do.
Truly. I mean, it's right on the pulse of what every American is talking about. After
right?
they finish talking about Barbie.
Right. Which is worth a lot of discussion.
we saw both.
We did see both.
We saw both. And we'll,
yeah, we
we'll
did not save... do a double feature, Barbenheimer.
No.
Feature, but
we saw Barbie first.
Mm-hmm.
Largely
when it came, the day it came out.
Yeah, we saw it Thursday, yeah. largely because I could not get tickets to IMAX Oppenheimer until the Monday after its opening weekend because it was just sold out. Mm-hmm. So we went to Oppenheimer Monday. And I say let's reserve our review for the end just in case people don't want to hear if they haven't seen it yet,
yeah,
you know,
absolutely.
For either movie. But right. I would say thumbs up for both.
Agreed.
Yeah.
Agreed.
Yeah, we can talk more about it at the end, maybe.
Both great times in the theater with very different moods. But yeah, we did see Oppenheimer.
Yeah.
We did enjoy it. Two thumbs up from both of us.
Yeah.
But I did find myself a little frustrated, and I certainly was not the only one. There's a million articles that you can read about this from film critics. But I did find myself a little frustrated by the lack of development from the women's characters, the women in the movie, who were very important to Robert Oppenheimer.
Right. Right. And I'll just jump in and say, you know, with this goes a little long. We definitely had to split it into two parts. But
surprise.
Yeah. But it actually works out really well, I think, because part one of this episode, it's very much like the biography of his life. And the movie is very much a biopic of Robert Oppenheimer. So for the most part, I don't personally feel like anything here is spoiler heavy in terms of anything from the movie being like, oh, shit. Whoa. Surprise. I'm so glad I didn't know that. Like, this is very much just kind of we're doing his life much the same way Nolan did. Mm-hmm. There is one major character death in his life that is a big impact. And we do say that in this episode. So I guess that's a little more spoilery, but it's also like it's history. So it's like, you know, heads up, the Titanic sinks. But
spoiler alert,
but
the boat's not around.
But it's OK. So
I also think that in this that particular case, it's maybe more interesting to know some of the history while you're watching it than the other way around.
Yeah.
So. And then enjoy looking it up after the movie.
Yeah, exactly.
As I did. So, yeah, we definitely will be referencing the movie throughout. So,
yeah.
Of course, if you haven't seen it and you don't want to be spoiled at all anyway,
if
feel free
like
to
me.
Save this until after you've seen the film.
If you're like me and like, I don't want to know his wife's name before I see it. I don't want anything in my brain.
Yes. Eli does not like
Tabula
at
Rasa.
All any information.
I can't stop thinking
Blank
about it.
Blank slate style.
I can't. It's a problem. I recognize it's a problem, but it's how I enjoy things.
I
so.
I do see that. Yeah. I do see that.
In part two of this episode of ours is just the tail end of his story, and it has a little bit more of like those oh shit moments from the movie where I would have rather not known that stuff going in. So I think you're basically, I'm saying I think you're safe with part one. And part two of this episode, maybe save until after you've seen the movie, if you care about that kind of thing. And we'll also get into our sort of response to the movie and the Barbie movie in part two as well.
Obviously, because it's a double feature of the millennium.
Definitely. So that's pretty exciting.
So at any rate, all that to say, a little frustrated about the lack of development for these women's characters. I wanted to know more about who they were, why they mattered to Oppenheimer, what part they played in this whole scenario. And, you know, I know a movie can't do everything, so not trying to talk shit about Christopher Nolan, whatever, whatever. But I just wanted to know more about him. I was really curious. So we figured that we would take this time on this episode to dive in, tell you a little bit more about Oppenheimer's personal trinity. The three most important women in his life, Jean Tatlock, Ruth Tolman, and his wife, Catherine Oppenheimer.
All right, I want to know.
Bombs away.
Okay.
Hey there, friends, come listen well. Eli and Diana got some stories to tell. There's no matchmaking or romantic tips. It's just about ridiculous relationships. A lover might be any type of person at all, an abstract concept or a concrete wall. But if there's a story worth a second glance, we'll put it in our show, Ridiculous Romance.
A production of iHeartRadio.
All right, we're going to start with Jean Tatlock, who Robert Oppenheimer met at a Berkeley House party in 1936. Now, her father was an acclaimed English scholar. He was an expert on Geoffrey Chaucer.
Oh.
And he was already friends with Oppenheimer. He was very impressed by Oppenheimer's literary knowledge.
Okay.
I guess for a scientific guy, he's a big reader. So he was like, I like you. We can chat about books. And Jean was no slouch herself, all right, in the brain department. She spent time with Jungian psychoanalysts in Switzerland.
Oh.
And then she attended Vassar College to study English.
Can you imagine hanging out with a bunch of Jungian psychoanalysts? It feels like an exhausting time
it
to
does.
Me.
I feel like every word I say, you're going to be like, oh my God, here
We're really
we go again.
Get into it. No, don't analyze me. I just wanted to get a cup of coffee.
Analyze this.
Analyze that.
The movie with Billy Crystal.
What a reference.
I would love to see Jungian psychoanalysts
watch
analyze this. and tell me
yeah.
how they feel about their field of science.
In the 1930s.
But exactly.
Yeah.
It'll be like, this is what's coming. This is what you've wrought. Katie Rich, who wrote a Vanity Fair article called Gene Tatlock, The Tragic Story of J. Robert Oppenheimer's Truest Love, writes that one of Gene's classmates once said that Gene Tatlock was, quote, the most promising girl I ever knew, the only one out of all I saw around me in college that even then seemed touched with greatness.
Wow. High praise from a classmate.
I know, right?
I feel like this classmate might have had a little crush.
Maybe. Maybe.
That's
like,
fair.
Gene was also super hot. And I loved her handwriting.
Mm-hmm. Is she going to read this? I thought she was the most promising person I ever met. The only one of us touched with greatness.
That's right.
And if I could get a touch of that greatness.
I'd love to touch that greatness myself. She graduated faster. She went to Berkeley to complete prerequisite courses that were required to enroll at Stanford Medical School. And this is when she also attended a fundraiser thrown by her landlady for the communist-backed Spanish Republicans fighting the Spanish Civil War. Mm. At this point, Jean was already a dues-paying member of the Communist Party, so she was already fully into all this stuff. She once told a friend, quote, I just wouldn't want to go on living if I didn't believe that in Russia, everything is better.
Oh, my.
Yay.
Yeah,
Our perspective of Russia is not great in 2023, I guess. So
no.
It seems like a very naive quote. But I suppose at the time, you were like, revolution is happening, some really exciting things in Russia.
Right, right. Well, the propaganda machine is strong across
truly
the world,
is.
In
across
all these big countries, us included.
Very true.
Now, another guest at this party was a man named, a tall, skinny guy named J. Robert Oppenheimer. He was 10 years older than Gene. And she inspired him in more ways than one. She got him into the poetry of John Donne, and we'll circle back to that later. But she also introduced him to her friends and the causes that she felt passionate about, like the Spanish Civil War and the plight of migrant workers. She probably turned to him and was like, you know, in Russia, everything's nice. You know, in Russia, she's probably going to shut up about it.
Yeah.
Like, we get it. You did your study abroad in Russia. Like, come on.
Workers in Russia, unite. Now it's time for the world's workers.
It's like me now. Like, well, you know, the wine in Italy doesn't have the sugar in it that the French wine does. So if you ever get a chance, everything's better in Italy.
Honeymoon alert.
But despite her introducing into all this ideology, Annabelle Nugent in the Independent article Oppenheimer's Women points out that Oppenheimer likely would have looked into communist ideology all by himself. He didn't need Gene's help necessarily, because his brother Frank and a lot of his colleagues at Berkeley were already members of the Communist Party. They were already outspoken critics of Franco's war in Spain. So it was all around him already.
Mm-hmm.
Now, Patricia Klaus and Shirley Straczynski, who wrote this book in 2013 called An Atomic Love Story, The Extraordinary Women in Robert Oppenheimer's Life, also point out that even Gene Tatlock's conservative father gave money to the ambulance corps.
Yeah.
They write, quote, I think that for Gene and Oppenheimer, their shared interest in psychology was a stronger bond. And from Gene, one of their friends would later say, Oppenheimer learned to be compassionate. So they're not having pillow talk about communism every night, right?
Like, yeah.
He's kind of like, yeah, I already know.
Right.
Communism's cool, whatever.
Sure, whatever.
And they had a lot of other stuff to talk about.
Yeah, well, and to point out that, like, communism as a whole was a very trendy thing.
Yeah.
And it was, a lot of people were very interested in it, whether they joined the party or not.
Right.
You know, they were very interested in a lot of what it had to say, a lot of the philosophy of it and so on. Of course, the practice, the way it was applied, naturally, we know, you know, with hindsight, how it all went down. But at the time, it was very exciting, very different way to think about things. A lot of people really, really into it.
Well, and that her father, who was conservative and probably, you know, leaned fairly against communism, was more pro-American capitalism, that kind of thing. Even people like that were looking at the ambulance corps. They're looking at the Spanish Civil War and they're like, yeah, I don't like what's going on over there. I might not be a communist, but what the fascists are doing is real bad.
Exactly.
Which, of course, would have been an ideology that permeated throughout the 1930s and 40s.
Exactly.
Because people were like, you know what? Today, fascism's worse.
Yeah, right. Let's think it through here.
Yeah.
But also, like, just the workers, the unionizing and the labor stuff was all wrapped up with the communist stuff.
Right.
But it was a very it was kind of its own thing. A lot of people were like, workers should really get paid normal money or shouldn't be working 1,000 hours and so on and so forth. So even if you were a conservative, you were like, yeah, y'all should unionize the ambulance workers. Right. Like, y'all should really get this going.
Right.
So
because people getting paid fair wages for their work is not inherently communist ideology.
Right. Right.
No matter how much they try to convince you, if you think people should be paid for their work, they must be communists.
You're a socialist, you're a communist. Yeah. Exactly. Yeah, yeah, we've seen it now.
Yep.
So, okay, in the movie, Jean is often shown pretty mad at Oppenheimer for getting her flowers. She'll take a bouquet and throw it immediately in the trash. Uh-huh. Apparently, that is true. She did tell him to stop getting her flowers all the time. He also proposed to Jean Tatlock two times, but she turned him down both times.
Third time's a charm, buddy.
Yeah, I know, right? He was like, I'm all geared up to ask her again. But for whatever reason, she did not want to marry him. But then Oppenheimer met Kitty Puning in 1939. I think I'm saying that right. And that kind of spelled the end of his affair with Jean. But they still met twice a year after he married Kitty. Oppenheimer explained during his security hearing in 1954, quote, "We had been very much involved with one another, and there was still a very deep feeling when we saw each other."
Mm-hmm.
They met up for the last time when Oppenheimer was in Berkeley in June 1943. At this point, he was the director of the Manhattan Project. The FBI was basically tailing him everywhere. They were paying attention to every little thing he did.
Mm-hmm.
Jean was a pediatric psychiatrist at Mount Zion. She was doing some very important work with troubled youth. So really great psychiatrist. Yeah. They don't talk about that in the film, but that's what she was up to. And so the FBI tailed Robert Oppenheimer and Jean to dinner and then to a hotel. They wrote in their official report, quote, "The relationship of Oppenheimer and Tatlock appears to be very affectionate and intimate."
Oh.
I don't know why he talks like that, but that's what he sounds
this,
like.
This FBI agent is quite the cool dude.
He's a really cool guy.
He's like a morning radio DJ. And, well, driving up the 505 and finding out that Robert Oppenheimer and Jean Tatlock have a very intimate and affectionate relationship. Back over to you, Joe.
J. Edgar Hoover liked to be entertained by his FBI reports, so you had to put on a little fun character.
Yeah. Yeah. Give me all the information you have on Martin Luther King, but make it silly.
Make it fun.
Do it in a funny voice. That does kind of sound like J.
Edgar
Hoover.
I do feel like you would. Totally. He'd be like, do it like you just sucked in a lot of helium. Go. Oppenheimer explained in his security hearing that Jean called him to visit her because, quote, "she was still in love with me." But this is when Oppenheimer ended their affair once and for all. And 7 months later, on January 4th, 1944, Jean Tatlock died by suicide.
I think it's really interesting with them. Their continued sort of deep relationship, I think, just shows what an intellectual companionship they had, right? Because that's someone who, they had a physical relationship, but I think it was the fact that they were on a similar level, that they had all these conversations about ideology or science or, you know, these things that they were both interested
literature.
In. And that became, literature and poetry.
Mm-hmm.
And so, of course, they still maintained that bond even after they separated. That is, I don't know, that's just intellectually intimate, right? Like that often, I think, never really goes away when you have that kind of connection with someone that goes beyond physical. So whether or not they continued their intimate, affectionate, physical relationship or not, they were always going to be connected like that, I think.
Yeah. I see that. I think they were still having a physical affair at this time, but I totally agree. It's one of those things. I don't know. Robert Oppenheimer is one of the smartest people in the world at this time.
Right.
How many people can he talk to?
Exactly, right.
Like, I mean, he's surrounded by a lot of very smart people. So he's fine.
Right,
we're not worried about him and his social life. But, you know, I just think it must have been very special to meet, especially a woman at that time. So it's just limited education opportunities.
Yeah.
So many women would leave school to have children or start a family or whatever.
Or discouraged from being there in the first place.
Exactly. Yeah. So, you know, it just might have been hard to find a woman that he felt like he could really have that kind of hold that level of conversation with.
Yeah.
So it'd be hard to let go of a person like
that. At the time of Jean's suicide, she had already been undergoing treatment for depression. Klaus and Straczynski in The Atomic Love Story suggest that she probably would have been diagnosed with bipolar disorder today.
Mm-hmm.
But losing her connection to Oppenheimer was a real blow. Kai Bird and Martin J. Sherwin, in their 2005 book, American Prometheus, which is the book that Nolan based the movie Oppenheimer on mostly. Mm-hmm. They wrote, quote, "For reasons of love and compassion, he had become a key member of Gene's psychological support structure. And then he vanished mysteriously. In Gene's eyes, it may have seemed as if ambition had trumped love."
Mm. He chose the bomb over me kind of thing. Not that she knew what he was working on.
Right. Or like his drive for, I mean, married to his job, you mm-hmm. know, like his relentless drive to succeed in what he feels like is his chosen or his predetermined path.
Right.
Is, I guess, more important than his time with me. Mm-hmm. For somebody who's already depressed, that can sting, I'm sure, really absolutely. Badly.
Well, he might have felt just like a buttress. Just even seeing him twice a year was enough. And then when he was like, "I can't see you anymore," it was like, oh, well, now that one string that's tying me down is gone. And so I'm just, you know, out here alone in the fucking cosmos, you know.
And, you know, in sort of, I don't know if it's defense of his character, but just sort of for clarification, you know, having seen the movie, he couldn't really go see her anymore. It was very difficult for him to get out of Los Alamos. He wasn't allowed to talk to anyone, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, so it's not so much that he was like, "Yeah, screw you, I'm more important. I'm more interested in work now." Mm-hmm. He might have been able to make a little more effort, but it was very difficult for him to get to see her. I mean, there was people that he was working for who were actively saying, "Don't you dare go see her. She's a communist."
Oh, yeah.
"And you're not allowed to go see anybody while you're working on this project."
Yeah, pretty much. And I mean, and he's married. He's got a wife.
Obviously,
so
yeah.
If he's going to spend time with somebody and give his heart to somebody, it should probably be her.
that little factor, too.
Yeah.
But an additional factor in Jean's suicide might have been that she was also struggling with her sexuality. Hmm. In An Atomic Love Story, they share a letter from her to a friend where she wrote, quote, "There was a period when I thought I was homosexual. I still am, in a way, forced to believe it. But really, logically, I am sure that I can't be because of my unmasculinity." And in American Prometheus, she tells a friend that she tried to overcome her same-sex attraction by, quote, "sleeping with every bull she could find." So doesn't that go right back into our very early stereotypical beliefs of what a homosexual person looks and behaves like?
Oh, yeah. She didn't know about lipstick lesbians.
Right. Or that she couldn't, or that if she slept with the manliest men she could find, that would, you know, undo her attraction to women.
Well, and she's a psychologist in an early part of this field, and that is what they believed for a long time. So she's feeling like she has the best information there is to have. And this is how shitty it's making her feel.
Yeah.
You know what I'm saying?
Exactly.
Anyway, tragically, it was Jean's father who found her the day after her suicide. Oh, and I just find that so upsetting.
Really heartbreaking, yeah.
He actually knocked on her door and did not get an answer. So he had to climb in through the window. And he found her on a pile of cushions by the bathtub with her head submerged in water.
Oh, my God.
She had left an unsigned suicide note, which read, quote, "I am disgusted with everything. To those who loved me and helped me, all love and courage. I wanted to live and to give, and I got paralyzed somehow. I tried like hell to understand and couldn't. I think I would have been a liability all my life. At least I could take away the burden of a paralyzed soul from a fighting world." This is such an interesting headspace. Mm-hmm. "Disgusted with everything. To those who loved me and helped me, all love and courage. I wanted to live and to give, and I got paralyzed. I tried like hell to understand and couldn't. I've been a liability." Who is she talking about? A liability to whom? What is she trying to understand? Is that got to do with her sexuality? Is that got to do with communism? Is that got, you know?
Right.
I don't
There's
know,
so many
but,
things in there that it could apply to.
And it might be all those things. It might be everything. She's like, everything in my life has been so confusing and hard.
And challenging.
And I'm done. I'm just done.
And it's a challenge to the people that I bring into my life. Mm-hmm. Like, she feels like I wonder if she's taking part of that with Oppenheimer, for example, where she's like, he's got government agents watching him all the time because he likes me and I'm a communist.
Yeah.
I'm you know, so I'm such a challenge for the people that I care about. Mm-hmm. That's a really difficult feeling.
Well, her father lay her body on her bed, and then he went through all her correspondence. He burned some letters and photographs, and then he called the police, trying to maintain her privacy, I imagine.
Right, yeah.
Because of Oppenheimer's 1943 visit to Jean, her phone had been wiretapped by the FBI. They decided she needed to be under surveillance. So actually, J. Edgar Hoover was one of the first people to learn that she was dead.
Wow. Boy, that guy was the first person to learn a lot of shit, wasn't
okay,
he?
Okay, he had his fucking fingers in way too many pies.
Mmm, pie. Make me a pie, but do it in a silly costume.
And then I'll eat it in a silly costume.
Yeah. Now, okay, speaking of J. Edgar Hoover, mm-hmm. there is a conspiracy theory, because there always is around this guy, because he certainly invited them.
He wanted it, and he got it.
There's a theory that Jean did not commit suicide, but possibly was killed by the FBI.
Ew.
Now, among other reasons, it's because one of the drugs found in her system was chloral hydrate, which is a chemical that you combine with alcohol to make a Mickey Finn.
Oh.
Or a concoction that'll knock someone out cold.
That's some Al Capone stuff.
Yeah. Give me old Mickey Finn.
Give me old Mickey Finn and drop him in the ocean.
Now, one doctor told the authors of American Prometheus, quote, "If you were clever and wanted to kill someone, this is the way to do it."
Yee.
But a number of things here don't really line up in terms of this conspiracy theory, because Jean herself would have had easy access to chloral hydrate on her own, since she worked as a psychiatrist in a hospital. And a Mickey Finn requires chloral hydrate to be mixed with alcohol, but there was no alcohol in Jean's system.
They definitely saw by like her state of her organs that she was a heavy drinker, but at that time she had no alcohol in her system.
Right, right.
So therefore the chloral hydrate
wouldn't have knocked her out.
Not necessarily, which still is like so weird that she would take it at all.
Why is it in her system to begin with?
For the water thing. Exactly. It's still weird.
Exactly.
But apparently that's not how a Mickey Finn works. So
now the prime suspect, according to Katie Rich in Vanity Fair, is supposedly Boris Pasch, who, if you have seen the movie, is Casey Affleck's character. Mm-hmm. And I won't say much if you haven't seen the movie, but if talk about shuddering. Okay. Talk about chills.
Very small part, real creep. But he really was a real creep.
Real creep. And so he's the prime suspect here. But Boris Pasch had actually been reassigned to London by the time she died.
Right. He was nowhere near her.
It's hard to say. Again, this conspiracy does kind of start to fall apart.
Yeah.
But no one could put anything past J. Edgar Hoover.
Nope.
And all his conspiracies seem to fall apart after a little while. And isn't that exactly how he would have designed them? So suspicions still linger today about whether or not she really killed herself. And I'll say, from what we've learned and the way that's presented the movie, which obviously is a movie, it's got its own ideas about how it wants to make you feel at certain times and stuff. But it's pretty suspect to me.
Honestly, they're both equally plausible.
Yeah.
Because Jean was not a happy person.
Right.
But yeah, I wouldn't, if it came out today that they've proved that the FBI or the CIA or whatever killed Jean Tatlock, I would be like, well, I'm not surprised.
Yeah, makes sense to me.
I'm not surprised doing that. Now, Oppenheimer was devastated, truly, truly devastated by Jean's death. His close friend, Robert Serber, says in American Prometheus, quote, "Jean was Robert's truest love. He loved her the most. He was devoted to her." Mm. When he was asked about what to name the atomic bomb test, he suggested Trinity as a tribute to Jean. It's taken from a devotional poem by John Donne, the poet that she had introduced him to.
Mm-hmm.
So let's go down to Poetry Corner and hear "Batter My Heart, Three-Personed God" by John Donne.
Batter my heart, three-personed God, for you as yet but knock, breathe, shine, and seek to mend, that I may rise and stand, o'erthrow me, and bend your force to break, blow, burn, and make me new. I, like an usurped town to another do, labor to admit you, but oh, to no end. Reason, your viceroy in me should defend, but as captive, and proves weak or untrue.
Yet dearly I love you, and would be loved fain, but am betrothed unto your enemy. Divorce me, untie or break that knot again, take me to you, imprison me, for I, except you enthrall me, never shall be free, nor ever chaste, except you ravish me.
This is one of those, like, historical moments where I'm like, did John Donne say, I got to write a poem for the guy who's going to invent the nuclear bomb one day? This just lines up so perfectly.
Kind of does. Like, the your force to break, blow, burn, and make me new.
Yeah.
Is like exactly what the atomic bomb did. It's so it's perfect. Mm-hmm. I can totally see why it came to his mind in relation to the atomic bomb.
And also, I'm kind of in love with this communist lady, but I'm betrothed unto your enemy. Like I'm literally part of the American government right now.
Right.
I'm set up with this destructive force that very much dislikes you. So divorce me, untie, or break that knot again. Can I get a break here?
Well, I also see it in terms of bigger, the bomb itself.
Uh-huh.
You know, he loves the science.
Yeah, sure.
But he's betrothed to the enemy of the science, which is all science is to make weapons. Right?
Yeah.
Like, wasn't that sort of the problem, was it, with all the scientists? They were like, I want to learn this. I want to understand the universe in this way. I want to see if this works.
Yeah.
But I don't want all our thought and all our theories and all our practice and all our math and everything else to lead up to a weapon of mass destruction.
Right.
I don't think that should be the culmination of my life's work.
Right.
And so it's very funny to just read it with that kind of in your mind, thinking about Oppenheimer, thinking, I love this. This is exactly what I want to be doing with my time, making and breaking and learning and discovering and changing and doing and theorizing and whatever. But the person I am betrothed to, the person I am beholden to, needs me to do something with you I don't like.
Yeah.
And that, I'm really upset about that. And I wish that I didn't have to.
Right.
You know?
Right, right.
I don't know.
Well,
you can read it a lot of different ways, but it works.
Yeah,
it does work.
Which is a sign of a great poem, right?
Very true. Great job, John. It's almost like John Donne.
John Donne.
Kind of good.
I think he's going somewhere.
Kind of good at writing.
Keep an eye on that kid as a poet, because I feel like the bell's going to toll for him.
Oh, is that John Donne?
Yeah, ever heard the bell tolls? Yeah, it tolls for thee, John Donne.
Excuse me.
Dunn. That's how you remember it's John Donne, because his name is like a bell.
Oh, smart.
But, okay, all that being said, we've got a couple more ladies to get to.
That's right.
We mentioned earlier that his affair with Jean was ended by his relationship with Kitty, who would later become his wife. So let's take a quick break and we will tell you all about Mrs. Oppenheimer right after these words.
This is it. Your moment. This is your time to make your comeback with Purdue Global. When you come back with a Purdue Global degree, you create opportunity for yourself, your family, and your future. It's a degree you can be proud of, a degree that employers will trust and respect. Purdue Global offers working adults like you over 175 flexible degree programs to meet your specific career goals. These include associate, bachelor's, master's, and doctoral degrees and certificates. Purdue Global degree programs range from nursing to business to communication and more. Whatever your interest, we have the degree that will move you forward. You have the knowledge. You have the experience. Now it's time to get credit for the work you've done and earn the recognition you deserve with Purdue Global, Purdue's online university for working adults. You know you're worth it. We do too. So don't wait another second to get the degree that will take your career to the next level. Start your comeback today at purdueglobal.edu.
LASIK. LASIK.com.
Have a ton of questions about LASIK? You're not alone. That's why we created LASIK.com, one place where you can go to find every answer to every question on your mind. Like, how much does LASIK cost? How long does recovery take? How do I find a doctor? If you've been thinking about LASIK, go to LASIK.com now. Yeah, LASIK.com. Easy to remember, so you know where to start.
LASIK, LASIK.com.
I'm Katya Adler, host of The Global Story. Over the last 25 years, I've covered conflicts in the Middle East, political and economic crises in Europe, drug cartels in Mexico. Now I'm covering the stories behind the news all over the world in conversation with those who break it. Join me Monday to Friday to find out what's happening, why, and what it all means. Follow The Global Story from the BBC wherever you listen to podcasts.
Before AI can help your business predict demand, accelerate growth, inform decisions, automate tasks, reveal insights, generate content, you have to trust it. Introducing Watson X Governance, helping you govern any AI as data, models, and policies change so you can scale it responsibly. Let's create AI that begins with trust with Watson X Governance. Learn more at ibm.com/governance. IBM, let's create.
Welcome back, everyone.
So Catherine Puning was an only child. She was born in Germany, but after her father, Franz, invented a new kind of blast furnace, her family emigrated to America in 1913 to make their fortune. Mm-hmm. Now, Kitty spoke both German and English fluently. She spoke English without any German accent. And she apparently claimed that her father was a prince and her mother was related to Queen Victoria.
Ooh, hoo, hoo.
She believed this. This was information given to her about her family and their past.
Yeah.
But it wasn't true. In fact, her mother's most famous relative was not Queen Victoria, but a cousin named Wilhelm Keitel, who was Germany's war minister during World War II, who was hated even by his own military colleagues for being too much of a yes man to Adolf Hitler.
Damn, even the Nazis were like,
other Nazis, yeah.
too much of a daddy's boy.
when the Nazis are like, whoa, calm down, bro, with the Hitler talk.
You're a real Führer, bro, and I don't care for it.
Yikes. Even Hitler himself said that Keitel, quote, had the brains of a movie usher.
Ouch. Even Hitler's like, what a dumbass.
Wow.
It's true, though. He said he was as loyal as a dog, though, so he would always let him do all kinds of crazy shit.
Although, kind of rude to movie ushers, Hitler. I guess another group that Hitler wasn't too fond of.
Yet another group that he discriminated ushers. Against.
Oh, not fans of Hitler on this show. tell your friends. So Catherine, who was better known as Kitty, went to Europe to study after high school. And it's not likely that she took many classes, but she did meet her first husband, Frank Ramseyer, a Harvard grad studying music in Paris. Now, crossover alert, Ramseyer's teacher was Nadia Boulanger, whose career was helped along quite a bit by our old friend, Winnaretta Singer.
Boom. Patronized.
It's a small world.
It is. So anyway, Kitty and Frank, they got married on Christmas Eve in 1932, but it did not last long. Kitty got an annulment only a year later on December 20th, 1933. Mm. She told friends that she had found and read Frank's diary and discovered that he was both gay and a drug addict.
Oh.
So she's like, let me get the fuck out of here. Which I was like, I have so many problems with it. First of all, she's reading his diary. Seems wrong.
Right.
You got a problem with personal property or something. But also, like, maybe she had to read it because she's like, there's something not right about Frank. He's running around doing crazy shit. And she's like, let me look at this diary, and finds out he's taking crazy drugs and seeing men on the side or whatever. At any rate, she said, let me get out of here. So at a New Year's party, only a few days later, Kitty met Joseph Dollett Jr. He was a Dartmouth dropout, card-carrying communist, and she moved in with him. Never married him officially, but she became his common-law wife.
Okay.
So they lived together long enough, basically, that they had legal protection. She joined the Communist Party after proving her loyalty by distributing copies of The Daily Worker on the streets. But they lived in like a dilapidated boarding house. They collected unemployment to get by. It was just kind of a real proletariat way of living that the blue-blooded Kitty kind of got fed up with. She said, I can't take it anymore. She moved back in with her parents. Months went by and she heard nothing from Joe. Which kind of pissed her off because she's like, I might not be living with you, but we're still together. So what's going on? And then she discovered that her mother, Kath, had been intercepting Joe's letters to her.
Oh, no.
And we won't get too much into Kath, but Ann Wilson, one of Oppenheimer's secretaries, said this about Kitty's mother, quote, she was a real dragon, a hard, repressive woman. She disappeared one day over the side of a transatlantic ship, and nobody missed her. That says it all.
Damn.
Damn, Anne. Anne is...
Wow. She fell off a ship and drowned, and we were like, bye.
Big deal.
See ya. Who? Kath who?
Kath who?
Wow.
I mean, that is a crazy thing to say about somebody.
That is. You got to really do something. I don't know what she did to Anne.
I don't either, but
it feels personal.
Pretty personal. But it was a huge rift between Kitty and her mom, of course, when she discovered this.
Sure. Now, the last letter from Joe to Kitty said that he was going to join a volunteer regiment in Spain to fight against Franco. So she finally gets a hold of these letters, finds out that this is going on. She traveled to Paris to meet up with him. And he went across the border into Spain, and he joined the Mackenzie Papineau Battalion. Mm-hmm. Joe would write Kitty letters from the front. One read, quote, "Each time up in the lines that I see a fascist, I am sure that I'll be more effective if I say to myself, that bastard is trying to keep you away from Kitty. So I'll say it and do my job right." So Kitty finally got permission to join him in Spain, but before she could arrange her travel, she had to be hospitalized for ovarian cysts, and she was sent back to England to recover. Then she was all set to leave for Spain when she found out that Joe had been killed in action on October 17th of 1937. His letters to her were published into a book the next year called Letters from Spain by Joe Dallet, American Volunteer to His Wife. Now, it might be that Joe Dallet was Kitty's Jean Tatlock in a way, because in a book by Janet Conant called 109 East Palace, Robert Oppenheimer and the Secret City of Los Alamos, Kitty's friend Shirley Barnett says that Dallet was, quote, the great love of her life, whose death she never really got over. So that's why she might be his Jean Tatlock in sort of that, like, she went on, you know, to have a long lasting marriage with someone else. But this was the one that mattered.
Yeah.
That really got to her. Yeah.
That might have been a point of, I don't know, of bonding between her and Robert.
I
wonder, you know, if they talked about anything like that and they both understood one another about having this person in their past who still was in their heart and was very important to them or whatever. Kitty came back to the U.S. She enrolled at the University of Pennsylvania to complete her undergraduate degree in botany, finally. That's what she was supposed to be doing all this time, but she was kind of having a good time, so she didn't do that. So she's finally trying to get her botany degree, and that's where she met Richard Stuart Harrison, a doctor with Oxford credentials. He proposed to her. She accepted, but only on the condition that he let her stay in Pennsylvania to complete her degree and then also allow her to pursue a postdoctorate to get her PhD, which was probably important to mention ahead of time at that time, because a lot of men in this time period would have expected her to leave school and start keeping his house and having his babies and stuff. So she probably was like, look, let me just let you know at the outset, I want a career as a botanist.
Yeah.
And he's like, cool, no problem. They were married in November 1938, and not long after, Richard left for his residency at Caltech. So they lived apart for 6 months. He's in California. She's in Pennsylvania. Then Kitty graduated with honors from UPenn. She's a smart lady. She was offered a research fellowship at Caltech. She was working with a physicist named Charles Lauritsen. So she finally moves to California, and she and Richard are, like, living in the same house, like husband and wife. In August 1939, her boss, Charles Lauritsen, and his wife threw a garden party. Richard and Kitty Harrison attended, and that is where she met the tall, slim, brilliant Robert Oppenheimer. Ooh. She was immediately enamored by him, and they started an affair pretty soon after.
Well.
I think this is kind of ridiculous because she's been married to Richard for, like, less than a year.
Right.
They've barely been married because he has not been in the same state as her for 6 months. And then she immediately starts sleeping with somebody else.
Well, it's tough to get a picture of Kitty's personality simply because everybody kind of seems to have their own opinion about her.
Yeah.
Like Kat Meads, in her article for Decadent Review, which is called Plaster Cast, Martini Glass, Potted Orchid, The Life of Kitty Oppenheimer, she lays out all the various things that people said against Kitty. First, you know, she was volatile, she was snooty, selfish, drunk, she was a bad mother, she was a bad daughter, she had a scathing tongue, she was an abusive friend or cruel, she could never be without a man, like all these really nasty things. And her sister-in-law, Jackie Oppenheimer, said, quote, Kitty was a schemer, she was a phony, all her political convictions were phony, all her ideas were borrowed, she was one of the few really evil people that I've known in my life.
I love your Jackie Oppenheimer. So fun.
But Kitty's friends said that she was vivacious and quick-witted. She was intelligent. She was actually really fun to be around.
Mm-hmm.
Her neighbor, who at first didn't like her but later became her friend, said, quote, at her worst, she was absolutely without guile, brave as a little lion and fiercely loyal to her own team.
Ooh.
And her friend Verna Hobson, who was one of Oppenheimer's secretaries, said, quote,
She was Robert's greatest confidant and advisor. He told her everything. He leaned on her tremendously. I don't know what that
JFK
was. Right?
Was that?
It was like Kennedy? JFK has been living in New Jersey for a couple of years. I don't know.
I want you to play every woman in a 1940s and 50s project.
Yeah, that'll go over well.
It'll work out great.
We felt like the women didn't get enough screen time in Oppenheimer, so Eli's going to play all of them.
Here's a man playing all of them. Oh, God. I'm part of the problem. All right, so Kitty and Oppenheimer started having an affair, and it was like hot and heavy from the get-go.
Yeah.
At one point, she went to see Oppenheimer at Christmas without her husband.
Whoops.
Just going to see Oppenheimer. Another time, Oppenheimer invited both Richard and Kitty to his ranch in New Mexico, Perro Caliente. Robert, at some point, had developed a weak case of tuberculosis. He was told, go to a warm climate, you know, to recover. Kind of like
Doc Holliday. Yeah, Tombstone, yeah.
Yep. So he went to a ranch in New Mexico, and he fell in love with the desert, absolutely loved it there. He found out that the ranch was available for lease, and he said, hot dog.
Perro Caliente.
So then he named it hot dog.
Oh, that's great. That's funny.
That's the story of the ranch.
Mm-hmm.
So anyway, he's like, come, you know, come on down to Perro Caliente, you guys, and like hang out on my ranch. Well, Richard said, oh, darn it. I can't go. I just got too much work.
Whoops.
At the hospital. So Kitty was like, well, I don't have any work. And she went alone. For 2 months, she stayed for 2 months with Robert Oppenheimer at his ranch, along with his friend Robert Serber and Robert's wife Charlotte.
Okay.
And thanks to her wealthy upbringing, Kitty was an expert horsewoman. She very much impressed people with her equestrian skills.
Yeah.
So she and Oppenheimer rode horses together all the time. And there's this fun story about how one time they rode out to stay overnight with a friend of Robert's named Katie. But the next day, Katie turned up at Perro Caliente because she had to return Kitty's nightgown, which had been left under Robert Oppenheimer's pillow.
Whoops.
She had to take that off and, like, tuck it up under the pillow. So it was kind of like, girl, you left this in a very obvious place.
Yikes.
I know exactly what y'all were doing.
Can I say, side note, we saw Oppenheimer, the 70mm IMAX up at Mall of Georgia, one of the few theaters in the world to have that print.
Yes, lucky us.
And I'll say, actually, oddly, it was almost too big. Like, I was having a hard time focusing on all the dialogue because I'm, like, turning my head left and right to listen to it. But the scenes where Robert and Kitty are on horseback in the New Mexico desert are some of the most beautiful shots I've seen on a, you know, 300-foot-tall screen, whatever it was. Just stunning. I mean, you know, y'all know if you listen to the show that we love the desert out there.
It's true.
But the beautiful scenery of them on this enormous IMAX screen riding horses across the New Mexico desert is unlike anything. Gorgeous.
Unparalleled.
Yeah. Now, with all these desert shenanigans, maybe it's no surprise that Kitty got pregnant while she was out there. Whoops.
Common side effect.
Uh-huh. And also
constant sex.
Yeah, right. And also, I gotta say, Richard, I don't know if he was just oblivious or didn't care or what, but he's like, oh, you're the guy that you love, that you spent Christmas with alone last year, invited us both out to the desert. Well, I can't go. Why don't you go yourself, honey, for a couple of months? Is, you know, I don't, again, I don't know if it's just, if he's just dumb or didn't care or was cool with it or what.
I wonder that too. I wonder that too. It's kind of making me think of a lot of our Parisian counterparts in even similar time frames.
Right.
Where they're like, oh, or British or whatever, where they're wealthy and they're like, I married somebody, but whatever. We all have our little, you know, our little side relationships, and it's very accepted in those circles. So maybe he was like, all right, whatever, as long as she's entertained. I'm busy, so fine. I guess. I don't know.
She was so allegedly a volatile person. She probably didn't hold back at all. So maybe he knew that it was like, I'm like, no, you shouldn't go by yourself, that all I'm going to get is an earful.
That's true.
And I don't feel like invoking the wrath of Kitty. So look, if you want to go spend a couple months with Robert, go for it.
Okay. Right. Or he maybe did get an earful and she just went and did what she wanted anyway, regardless.
Yeah.
Who knows?
Yeah.
Okay. Well, let's take a quick break and then we'll come back and we'll hear a lot more about this pregnancy.
Oh, boy.
What kind of parents the Oppenheimers were and lots more. So we'll see you in a minute.
Yeah.
This is it. Your moment. This is your time to make your comeback with Purdue Global. When you come back with a Purdue Global degree, you create opportunity for yourself, your family, and your future. It's a degree you can be proud of, a degree that employers will trust and respect. Purdue Global offers working adults like you over 175 flexible degree programs to meet your specific career goals. These include associate, bachelor's, master's, and doctoral degrees and certificates. Purdue Global degree programs range from nursing to business to communication and more. Whatever your interest, we have the degree that will move you forward. You have the knowledge. You have the experience. Now it's time to get credit for the work you've done and earn the recognition you deserve with Purdue Global, Purdue's online university for working adults. You know you're worth it. We do too. So don't wait another second to get the degree that will take your career to the next level. Start your comeback today at purdueglobal.edu.
LASIK, LASIK.com.
Have you been thinking about LASIK but not sure if you're a candidate? Just go to LASIK.com/quiz and take our free candidacy quiz. In just a few minutes, you'll know if LASIK is likely right for you. And if it is, we'll connect you with experienced LASIK doctors in your area. Start your journey towards 20/20 vision. Take our free candidacy quiz at LASIK.com/quiz. Yeah, LASIK.com. Easy to remember, so you know where to start.
LASIK, LASIK.com.
I'm Katya Adler, host of The Global Story. Over the last 25 years, I've covered conflicts in the Middle East, political and economic crises in Europe, drug cartels in Mexico. Now I'm covering the stories behind the news all over the world in conversation with those who break it. Join me Monday to Friday to find out what's happening, why, and what it all means. Follow The Global Story from the BBC wherever you listen to podcasts.
Before AI can help your business predict demand, accelerate growth, inform decisions, automate tasks, reveal insights, generate content, you have to trust it. Introducing Watson X Governance, helping you govern any AI as data, models, and policies change so you can scale it responsibly. Let's create AI that begins with trust with Watson X Governance. Learn more at ibm.com/governance. IBM, let's create.
Welcome back, everybody. Last we left, Kitty and Robert were in the desert together, and they had gotten pregnant.
Yeah.
And Kitty had gotten her divorce and got Robert to marry her.
Yeah. One of the more damning things that people had to say against Kitty was that she sort of maybe forced Robert's hand on this one. She admitted to his secretary, Ann Wilson, that she got him to marry her, quote, the old-fashioned way. So she got pregnant on purpose with him. And
yeah.
I mean, again, when you're sleeping with someone for 2 months, it's hard not to like to be like, oh, it was on purpose. Like, yeah, mm-hmm. I mean, she didn't try to not do it.
Exactly.
Right?
Yeah.
And it worked. Robert called Richard Harrison to break the news, and he convinced Richard to give Kitty a divorce so that he could marry her instead. Bird and Sherman in American Prometheus wrote, quote, it was all very civilized.
I mean, I guess that's preferable,
and I'm
but...
just, beep, beep, beep.
Hello, Mr. Richard Sherman? Robert Oppenheimer here. Yes, yes. Yes, I'm here with your wife, Kitty. so sorry to send you this uncomfortable news, but by Jove, I seem to have gotten your wife pregnant.
By Jove?
You know, it's the funniest thing. I don't know how it happened. But thought maybe I ought to marry her instead of you. How do you feel about that, sir?
Oh, everything you say sounds good. I mean, you gotta make her an honest woman out of her.
Yeah, right.
I certainly couldn't.
Oh yeah, speculation station. Richard was like, oh, thank God.
Maybe
yeah,
he was.
Please.
I mean, I don't know.
Please go for it.
He might have been, because I think the main argument he had against it was that getting a divorce would harm his, like, reputation or something.
Yeah.
You know, because it still was not great to get a divorce.
Right, right, right.
So he was kind of like, I'm worried about my professional, you know, my career or whatever, yeah, if I get a divorce.
Yeah.
So it wasn't so much like, but I love her, you know?
Yeah. So Kitty moved to Reno, Nevada for 6 weeks and got her divorce, mm-hmm, which we have mentioned in previous episodes that Nevada, for the longest time, maybe still, was like the place to get a quick divorce.
That's right.
They specifically crafted their laws to promote divorce tourism, basically. So she got her divorce there and she married Robert Oppenheimer the very next day on November 2nd of 1940. In May of 1941, Kitty gave birth to their son, Peter Oppenheimer.
But as Kat Meads writes, quote, he would not be the focus of either of his parents' lives. Mm. In fact, Robert and Kitty left Peter with their friends, the Chevaliers, for 2 months while they took a vacation to Perro Caliente. Now, at this point, Robert started seeing Jean Tatlock again.
That's right.
So this is before her suicide. Mm-hmm. This was with Kitty's knowledge, although maybe not her approval. He might have been real similar to her in terms of just like, look, I'm going to do
this. What I'm going to do.
Yeah.
Although it makes me wonder, knowing about Joe Dallet and thinking, did they ever, you know, get close in that way where they said, this is the person I really love.
Right.
You know, of course, I love you and we're good, but like, this is my love. You know what I mean? And so she was maybe more able to understand about Jean than it would seem from
first. We have old loves in our lives that are forever part of us, right? So she might have understood that better than most. Maybe
she might have been like, if I had broken up with Joe, I think I might still be wanting to see him too. So I get it. You know, but she might have gotten it even if she didn't like it.
Yeah, simultaneously that might even make it worse for her too. It'd be like, oh, you're gonna go hang out with the one that got away, the true love of your life.
Cute.
Yeah. But then everything really changed because Japan bombed Pearl Harbor and the U.S. entered World War II. At this point, Robert Oppenheimer was put in charge of the Manhattan Project.
Originally, Kitty was like sort of excited about this whole Manhattan Project, Los Alamos thing. She's like, cool, we like to camp and stuff. Like, this will be fine. But life in Los Alamos was really hard on the scientists' wives. It was harder than anyone could have predicted.
Yeah.
Again, if you haven't seen the movie or you don't know much about this time period, just a quick debrief on Los Alamos. In order to test this bomb, they had to be somewhere in the country where there wasn't a lot of residents, you know, around to be affected or to see what they were up to.
Yeah.
And they built a city in the middle of middle of nowhere in Mexico, and they called it Los Alamos. So that's what this is.
There was
hastily erected city.
Yeah. There was so much paranoia about, even though we were allied with them, about Russian spies trying to learn about what we were doing. And obviously the Germans as well. Mm-hmm. But in particular, the American government was worried about communist spies also, copying what we had, because everyone was working on nuclear science
at
this point and how to split the atom and how to turn that into a weapon. Mm-hmm. So incredibly secretive. That's why Robert, among the reasons Robert wasn't allowed to leave Los Alamos, really, or go see Gene or, even speak candidly with any of his colleagues or his family or anything like that. None That's of them right. living there were.
Very top secret situation. So Los Alamos, kind of a hard place to live, turns out. They're in the desert. Water, electrical power, both very scarce.
Mm-hmm.
Fruits and veggies, not fresh,
because
they're having to truck them in from wherever.
Uh-huh.
Their husbands could not talk to them freely about their work as they had before.
Yeah.
So there's this whole new strain on their marriages.
Even within Los Alamos,
exactly.
You couldn't go home and talk to your partner about what you
That's
did at work today.
Everybody in the city had different security clearances. So you literally couldn't, you had to lie. I mean, you had to, even if you're not lying, it's still, there's a strain, right? If you can't talk openly with your spouse. Yeah. So there was a strain in these marriages.
It'd be like me coming to you if I still worked in movies and television and saying, hey, we're moving to the middle of the desert because I got a gig on a show. Mm-hmm. And you're like, cool, what's the show? I signed an NDA. I can't tell you.
Mm-hmm.
You're coming with me. Mm-hmm. You're going to live in a ramshackle apartment with no air conditioning. And I'm going to be working for 16 hours a day. And when I come home and you say, how was work? I'm going to say, what work?
Yeah, right?
I mean, sounds fun.
Kind of. I know, right? Of course, these women could not reveal to their relatives where they were.
Right.
So they couldn't have any visitors. They couldn't liven shit up with any kind of anything like that.
Right.
Mail was censored going in and out. No visitors were allowed, et cetera, et cetera. This was a really difficult place to live. In the book Standing By and Making Do, Women of Wartime Los Alamos, a woman named Jane Wilson writes, quote, in the mountains of New Mexico, the women aged.
Ooh.
We aged from day to day. Living at Los Alamos was something like living in jail.
I bet quite literally, too, because, they didn't have the moisturizer technology that we have today.
They literally were aging in that sand. Very true. Kitty worked briefly as a lab tech, so she actually did work on the project to an extent. She was examining blood to see the effects of radiation poisoning. but she then got pregnant.
Oh,
and
yeah.
Stopped working. And she was far from the only one to get pregnant. Yeah, we just talked about how boring Los Alamos is. What else is there to do? And The Atlantic says that the Los Alamos baby boom was so big that General Leslie Groves started being like, the U.S. Army shouldn't have to pay all these maternity bills.
What? Well, excuse me, Mr. Groves, but it's your fault we got all these maternity bills to begin with.
I was like, bitch, you're already spending billions of dollars on this project. Like, what's a few baby deliveries?
Right.
Calm the fuck down. But that's probably why he was like going through trying to penny pinch or whatever. I think that's just funny thinking about Leslie Groves being like, too many babies. Whatever. So anyway, she got pregnant. And in December 1944, they welcomed Catherine Tony Oppenheimer to the world. And like every other baby born at Los Alamos, the birthplace was recorded as P.O. Box 1663.
Oh,
of course,
I see.
They couldn't.
Because when you turn that upside down, it's
yes,
E. 99I, which is the formula for nuclear things. For your, like, I don't know.
You're circling, find it.
There's something. There's a conspiracy. It's up. P.O. Box 1663. You rearrange that and you get 3X06BPPTPP. Look.
Oh, God.
Well, after Tony was born, Kitty had some serious depression. Now, partly, obviously, this was from just being isolated at Los Alamos, right? Probably one of the most depressing towns in America at the time. Built out of plywood in a day, you know. And
bunch of government guys running around. Gross.
Ugh, gross. No one can talk to each other. You go out and try to have a drink with friends. Oh, what you been up to? You know, I can't talk about that. Mm-hmm. What have you been up to? Oh, you know, I can't talk about that.
I mean...
Cool.
I hope you all read a book or something.
Right.
You got a book club or something.
Yeah, right. The Los Alamos Book Club. But her depression also probably came partly due to some postpartum depression, right?
So, which they think she probably had after Peter as well.
So all this being said, she left Tony with another scientist family and moved back to her parents' house for 3 months. And she took their son, Peter, with her. Mm-hmm. So obviously, like, Robert's too busy to be single dad because he's heading up the nuclear bomb project. And she needed to get out of town. So while Kitty's out of town, let's turn our attention to the third woman in this Oppenheimer trinity, which also brings us to this episode's side piece.
Great minds think alike.
Dr. Ruth Sherman Tolman was a powerhouse smarty pants. That's an official term.
That's right.
That was her degree.
TM.
She was a clinical psychologist. She's a university professor. She's the author of 6 books. And she created some of the first treatments for post-traumatic stress disorder and was the first woman elected to the Society for the Psychological Study of Social Issues. So just a lot of boxes checked Dr. Ruth Sherman Tolman here. Her husband was Richard Tolman, and his brother created this panel with the psychological study of social issues. So there was some controversy about her being elected to the panel, like maybe there was a little nepotism going on here. And Ruth said, hell no, straight up, like, I worked hard. I'm damn good. I got this on my own merit.
That's
it don't
right.
matter who my brother-in-law is. Mm-hmm. I deserve this position.
So she, instead of being in the Oppenheimer movie, was in the Barbie movie saying, I worked hard and I deserve this.
Right. Yeah, exactly. Exactly.
Hi, Barbie.
So during the war, she was recruited to several government agencies who were hiring psychologists. And she worked to address the discrimination that women psychologists were experiencing. Women psychologists weren't being informed about new scholarly findings, for instance, stuff like that. Just like an active campaign to keep women out of the field.
It wasn't just like, I feel disrespected by my male co.
No.
It was like, literally, they're not telling me information I need to know about my field of study.
Yeah. She walks into a room and is like, oh, I didn't realize there was a meeting today. And they're like, oh, yeah, we're just ending. Sorry, forgot to tell you.
Right.
Bye.
Wrote it on the men's bathroom wall.
Uh-huh.
Too bad you didn't see it.
Yeah.
You know, that type of shit.
Now, her final wartime assignment was developing psychological stability tests for field agent assessments for the Office of Strategic Services, which is now known as the CIA. So she came in, was like, can you handle it here?
Yeah.
Here's answer these 10 questions. We're going to find out which the bear character are you? And that'll tell me whether or not she's the original BuzzFeed quiz.
Then she moved on to making BuzzFeed quizzes about which kind of onion you are. I just think that's so cool. Yeah, she had to figure out, I guess, probably A, can you handle it?
Yeah.
And B, are you a psychopath and you will make horrible decisions,
right,
you know, in the field and stuff. So,
right.
So she's doing some serious fucking work.
Because you might be like, oh, this guy, he's brilliant.
Oh.
And he can totally handle the pressure.
He can kill anybody.
And he's a sociopath who doesn't care about human life. So maybe we shouldn't have him in charge of the A-bomb. You know, yeah.
Right, exactly. There's a different place for him.
Right.
In the Guantanamo or something.
But let's not put him there either.
I know, right? Actually, don't put him in the CIA.
Yeah.
Probably.
Yeah, maybe he's just
not a government employee.
Cold Stone Creamery or something is better for him.
Well, I tried to work at the CIA, but I'm applying today at Cold Stone Creamery because they said I was too much of a psychopath.
Yeah, I didn't value human life enough. So
and they're
anyway,
perfect for a Cold Stone.
Is that butter pecan you said? All right.
All right. So Ruth, total boss bitch. She's also about 10 years older than Robert Oppenheimer. So just so you have her age correct.
The flip between
the
him
flip,
and
exactly.
Gene.
She's older
yeah,
than him.
Yeah, okay.
And Richard and Ruth had been friends with Robert Oppenheimer for years.
Sure.
Richard Tolman actually literally wrote the book on statistical mechanics. 100% literally wrote that book. And Oppenheimer used his work to prove his theories about stars collapsing into black holes. It's called the Tolman-Oppenheimer-Volkoff limit.
I love that. And this is something that I learned from the movie, too, in the opening scenes, mm-hmm. is that Oppenheimer basically came up with the idea that stars collapse into black holes.
I did not know that
he was involved in astrophysics like that. That's so cool.
It's funny how much of this quantum mechanics and stuff I thought was older than it was. And of course, at this time, it was brand new field of study. So it's really interesting. I'm not smart enough to understand any of it, but I love it. I think it's fascinating. So Richard Tolman, also badass brain guy. And he worked as one of General Leslie Groves' scientific advisors during the war.
Okay.
So he and Ruth both high-level government work, government service during the war.
Yeah.
So they bought a house in Washington, D.C. And Oppenheimer usually stayed with them when he had to travel to the Capitol for meetings. He didn't leave Los Alamos very much. But when he did, it was to, like, meet with politicians, tell them how it was going, get you know, new deadlines or whatever.
Yeah, yeah.
So he would usually stay there. And most scholars say that Ruth and Robert Oppenheimer had an affair, usually starting around the time of her CIA service, of this OSS assessment test. Atomic love story authors Klaus and Straczynski told The Independent, quote, Ruth and Robert were deep and close friends for decades. He may have loved Kitty, but on some level, he did not respect her. Ruth, he respected and admired. He relied on her for advice and the sort of comfort only a good friend can provide. One of Oppenheimer's secretaries said he always kept one of Ruth's letters in his pocket. And Megan George, writing for FeministVoices.com, says, quote, friends would often drop into the Tolman residence to find the couple alone in their dressing gowns, and says the affair went on after Richard Tolman died as well. So it was kind of a long-standing thing.
But Klaus and Straczynski also decided after all their research that there was no evidence of a physical affair between these two. At most, this was just like a very close emotional bond, right? Mm-hmm. Two people found something they can connect to that probably, again, as with many of the people in Oppenheimer's life, how many people can he actually talk to on a certain level?
Yeah.
Right? There's not many out there. Mm-hmm. So he got very close to people like this. Klaus and Straczynski told The Independent that Ernest Lawrence, who's the character that Josh Hartnett plays in the movie, was likely responsible for all the rumors that were flying around about Oppenheimer and Ruth because he had, quote, a long list of grievances, personal and professional, against Oppenheimer.
Damn, so he was just stirring the
talking shit. But they also point out that Kitty, who was known as, quote, a jealous person, never showed any signs of being suspicious of her husband and his friend Ruth.
Mm-hmm.
Although clearly she would have had plenty of reason to. He's spending so much time with her. But maybe she was quite clear and knew that there wasn't an affair going on between them.
Right. It's also like he doesn't seem to be very secretive about his affairs. Like
right.
He kind of tells, listen, I'm going to go see Jean.
Yeah.
And she's like, I don't care if you like it or not.
Yeah.
You know, just that's what I'm doing. So I don't know why he would lie about Ruth to her. You know, why would he cover that up? But anyway.
So all that to say, it's not really clear how sexual this relationship might have been, whatever that's worth. But it's presented more or less as fact in the movie that they had a sexual relationship. And it seems to be mostly accepted by a lot of Oppenheimer and Ruth biographers.
Right.
Some even say that Richard Tolman, her husband, died of a broken heart when he discovered their affair. Because he died of a heart attack in 1948. And I'll say, based on what we've heard here, husbands of the 1930s and 40s, maybe stop making Robert Oppenheimer you and your wife's best single friend, because he keeps coming in and falling in love.
He will steal your wife.
With your wife. Like, it's, and she loves him too. So maybe hide your wives from Robert Oppenheimer,
hide
fellas.
Hide your fucking wives. And I will say, these are only three of the women that he was with. Robert Oppenheimer was with many other women.
Yeah.
And some of them were married. He very frequently had affairs with married women.
Here's the thing about Oppenheimer. He seems very towering, and he's got this really, like, just kind of impressive presence. He seems like he's so smart. He's kind of intimidating. But one of the reasons that they picked him for leading the Manhattan Project is that he was so dang personable.
That's right.
People loved him. They liked hanging out with him. He was really charming. He knew how to work with people. He knew how to talk to people. And he's just very likable, which I did not expect to learn about him as we were studying. I figured he would have been one of these, like, cold scientists that's sort of difficult to communicate with because he's just operating on a different level. But he was actually kind of a total just dude.
Yeah.
Just like a guy.
Which I kind of love knowing. Like, he's the type of intellectual person that just, like, he was so curious about such a wide variety of subjects that he was really interested in the people he was talking to, I think, for the most part.
Carl Sagan gives me that
impression. And he could talk about a lot of things.
Yeah.
Yeah, Carl Sagan is a great example. People did say with Robert Oppenheimer, he was just so magnetic that male or female, you just couldn't help but fall in love with him on some level or another. So, yeah, maybe hide your wives around Oppenheimer. So Robert Oppenheimer may or may not have been having a bi-coastal affair with his friend's wife in D.C., dealing with his postpartum depressed wife, Kitty, and trying to get the atomic bomb completed successfully all at the same time.
No pressure.
No pressure, sir.
Maybe as much pressure on him as there was inside the hydrogen bomb.
Yeah, yeah.
Which we learned is all about pressure.
Quite a lot of pressure going on in there. So, you know, if he was not actually sleeping with Ruth, whatever she did provide in the way of making him feel better about his life, I think he needed it. he needed that letter or whatever she was saying to him. Regardless of the security protocol and stuff on Los Alamos, Robert Oppenheimer did keep Kitty in the loop about what he was up to. So when the Trinity test was successful, they did that on a mesa miles and miles away from Los Alamos.
Right.
So the wives are on Los Alamos. They have no idea what's going on. Their husbands have gone off to try this shit and they don't know what's happening.
Mm-hmm.
But of course, you know, he wants to share with Kitty whether or not any of this shit worked.
Yeah, whether it was worth it.
Right. So, but he can't, of course, can't call her and be like, all right, great job, babe. Like,
oh, yeah, they're listening to every phone call.
Exactly. So what he did was he called Kitty and told her, quote, "You can change the sheets."
That was
their little code. Okay. So he was still telling her what was up.
Yeah.
And clear, like, you know, just through all three of these women, you're seeing how much he needs their advice. He likes to hear what they have to say. Like, he apparently was Kitty was his main confidant. He clearly got advice from Ruth. Before Jean died, he clearly needed to hear from her and have her be a sounding board for him. So I think, even as differently as he loved or respected or whatever these women, he clearly did have a lot of respect for their brains.
Right.
Regardless of how great they looked and to us on the outside. Yeah.
Well, and I do wonder if this is one of those situations where, and I know this is true in the past, it's still true today, I'm sure, where because he's a man and they are women, there's a degree to which, oh, I like you. I'm friends with you. I respect you. Mm-hmm. I consider you my equal. I must be romantically in love with you.
Right.
You know, and he can't differentiate, you know, and then if you're attractive on top of that and I'm, physically attracted to you, well, here we go. The only solution that we must want to be doing it, you know, as opposed to just like another one of his guy friends. They're equals. They have brilliant conversations. And that's it.
Yeah.
Like, we don't have to sleep with each other.
Mm-hmm.
But I wonder if that ties into it, if he sort of misconstrued his feelings of companionship and respect and just that sort of mutuality that they had intellectually.
Yeah.
Confused that with feelings, like intimate feelings.
I could totally see that.
Yeah.
I could completely see that being a problem. Yeah. People today still have a really hard time, as you said.
Yeah. I think that's how we got together, right?
What?
Well, when it started, you know, it blossomed into something different.
Oh, good. I'm glad it blossomed.
It's getting there.
Oh, my God. I'm gonna kick you out of this room. All right. So the Trinity test worked and the atomic bomb was dropped and so on and so forth. We know all that part pretty well.
Yada, yada, yada.
He changed the world. But once the war was over, of course, Robert Oppenheimer was a big shot.
Yeah.
He's a giant celebrity. Everybody was like the greatest, most respected mind in the entire country. He had won the war, et cetera, et cetera.
Right.
So he took a job at the Institute for Advanced Study at Princeton, where Kitty raised orchids. She kind of got back to her botany roots, and she had a greenhouse. She raised orchids there. And Robert would have rare species shipped in for her birthdays, so she would have new species to hang out with. But also, by this time, Kitty, by some estimations, had become a bad drunk, bad alcoholic.
Yeah.
She had always drank pretty heavily, but throughout her time at Los Alamos, but it was really after that apparently it got kind of uncontrollable. She often had broken bones or bruises from drunken falls or car crashes. Mm. She would fall asleep smoking cigarettes, so she burned holes into her nightclothes and her sheets. Once she even set the house on fire.
Oh, my God.
She was also in a lot of pain from pancreatitis, and she took a lot of painkillers for that.
Mm.
So Oppenheimer's friend, Robert Serber, actually says that all her falls and other erratic behavior is due to the pills.
Oh.
He insisted that she did not drink any more than a normal person, which, let's just take that with a grain of salt. It's the 50s.
Yeah, what
everybody's
you think
drinking
is normal?
Incredibly heavily.
Yeah. But well, she has like 6 drinks a day. Like, who
doesn't? Normal, she gets up, she has a martini. Who doesn't?
Yeah.
So,
just like me, a normal person.
Right. So, you know, his idea of what was a normal amount of drinking might not match ours today. But he did think that a lot of her falling asleep or all that stuff was more about the painkillers.
Sure, yeah.
And a lot of their friends did say Robert Oppenheimer was pretty ambivalent about Kitty's drinking, didn't seem to find it to be a problem. So, but every portrayal of Kitty is as a drunk. So it was a big part of her characteristic, at least on the outside for most people, that she was drinking a bit too much.
Yeah. Okay, so we're well over the hour mark at this point. We've been having a great time learning about these women that Robert Oppenheimer got with.
Mm-hmm.
Definitely, I think, easily arguable that they also changed the course of history through their involvement.
Sure, I think so.
This whole event that really changed everything. So, but there's more to tell, and it's too much. It's too much at once, right? It's too much. And also, as we said at the beginning of the episode, I personally think that the rest of the story, we're going to be referencing stuff that does kind of come as a surprise in the third act of the movie, because we're, you know, later into his life here.
Mm-hmm.
And I was so just kind of shocked by some of those moments in the movie that, you know, I think it's better to see it first.
Yeah, right.
Again,
on.
If you're a person who cares about that kind of stuff,
totally.
I'm a sensitive spoiler boy, so that's that gets to me. But there is definitely more to touch on. You've got another 20 minutes or so worth of story for Oppenheimer, and then the rest of part two, and we're dropping these both at the same time, so you can go right into it if you want. We're going to give our, I don't think review is the right word so much as just like our thoughts.
Yeah, I think that's fair.
Yeah, on Oppenheimer and Barbie.
That's right, right, of course.
Yeah.
Of course, the two movies that every actor in Hollywood was in.
Seriously, oh my God, it's everyone you've ever heard of. It's in these two movies or episode 6 of The Bear.
Of The Bear.
That was the rest of them.
If you weren't on any one of those three projects, somebody lost your number.
It's like, it's like how every British actor is in either Harry Potter, Doctor Who, or Game of Thrones.
Or Downton Abbey.
Oh, sure. Or Downton Abbey.
All of them, really.
And that kept England's actors working for a long time. And
sure did.
I think the rest of all actors were either in Oppenheimer, Barbie, or episode 6, season 2 of The Bear.
At least they're working.
Yeah. Well, we're working too. We got a whole other episode to bring you. I think it's really fun stuff. Please stick around, listen up, and let us know what you think of our little movie pseudo review too, because we have a great time talking about movies.
We sure do.
Yeah, and we will talk your ear off if you give us the space. So that's what we did. So go ahead, hop on over to episode 2 right now, finish up Oppenheimer's story. Mm-hmm. And as always, let us know what you thought.
Yeah, you know, we always love to hear from you guys. We love your suggestions. We love your random thoughts about stupid things we said or about the story overall or whatever. So reach out. Our email is ridicromance@gmail.com.
That's right. You can find us on Instagram. I'm at Oh Great, It's Eli.
I'm at Dynamite Boom.
And the show is at ridicromance.
And you are awesome.
You sure are. Pop over for episode 2, and we'll catch you at that one.
I love you. Bye.
So long, friends. It's time to go. Thanks for listening to our show. Tell your friends, neighbors, uncles, and aunts to listen to our show, Ridiculous Romance.
From BBC Radio 4, Britain's biggest paranormal podcast is going on a road trip.
I thought in that moment, oh my God, we've summoned something from this board.
This is Uncanny USA.
He says, somebody's in the house, and I screamed.
Listen to Uncanny USA wherever you get your BBC podcasts, if you dare.
Xumo Play is your destination for endless entertainment. With a diverse lineup of 350-plus live channels, movies, and full TV series, you'll easily find something to watch right away. And the best part? It's all free. Love music? Get lost in the 90s with iHeart 90s, dance away with hip-hop beats, and more on the iHeart Radio music channels. No logins, no signups, no accounts, no hassle. So what are you waiting for? Start streaming at play.xumo.com or download from the app and Google Play stores today. All you can stream with Xumo Play.
Xfinity has free premium networks for everyone this month, no matter what kind of entertainment you love. Addicted to true crime? Catch killer cases and more spine-tingling shows on A&E Crime Central. Crave adventure? Explore Asian action movies on Hayah. Searching for something extreme? Check out skating, snowboarding, and more on Fuel TV Plus, the global home of action sports. And find crowd-pleasing bops on iHeartRadio's Hit Nation playlist. There's new free shows and movies to love every week. Say free this week in your Xfinity voice remote.
Since every minute counts when you're a new parent, who wants to waste time washing bottles? Transform this daily chore with the Baby Brezza Bottle Washer Pro, the first machine that automatically washes, sterilizes, and dries bottles, pump parts, and sippy cups at the push of a button. Its 20 spray jets clean everything 100%. Plus, it sterilizes with steam, then dries with germ-free air. Don't waste time on tedious hand washing. Let the Baby Brezza Bottle Washer Pro do it for you. Shop now at babybrezza.com.